Good afternoon and welcome back. My name is Daniel Byman. I am the research director of the Saban Center at Brookings. And our topic for this session is looking at the Middle East and the implications of events and developments there for the G8. I think it's no secret, especially based on discussion and some of the initial questions this morning, that what's going on in the Middle East, very broadly defined, is going to be an important part of the agenda and discussions of the G8. However, the countries involved have different interests in the region and different priorities, but I think it's safe to say that the region is going to be is and will remain incredibly important for all of them. I am delighted that today we have two excellent speakers from Brookings to talk on the subject. To my left is Bruce Riedel. I've asked him to begin some initial remarks on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Bruce is a 30-year veteran of the intelligence community. He's also held senior positions in the White House and in the Department of Defense. And while at Brookings, has authored several books on al-Qaeda and Pakistan and the implications of crises there. To my right is Suzanne Maloney. She has served in a senior position on Iran with the Department of State. She is one of a top handful of Iran experts that has been guiding, or I should say trying to guide, policy to make it more coherent, and as someone who is widely regarded as one of the most informed voices on Iran. I've asked them to prepare some initial remarks before I open it up for your questions. So without further ado, let me turn things over to Bruce, please.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for that very kind invitation. I'm going to merge the G8 and the NATO summits together because I think that for Afghanistan in particular, you can't talk without talking about NATO. Afghanistan is, this time, I think actually pretty much a good news story for these summits. That is not to say that we are on the edge of nirvana, nor even Valhalla, as Bob Gates once said we were going to emerge in Afghanistan. But I think we can, and the leaders will be able to point to substantial progress over 2, 3, or even 4 years ago in Afghanistan. I think first, of course, is progress in terms of the war against al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda core, al-Qaeda senior leadership, whatever you want to call it, I prefer to call it Mother al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda al-Umm in Arabic, is a severely damaged organization. The combination of the SEAL raid that killed Osama bin Laden and the drones that have decimated its senior leadership, this is a much diminished organization. And that would not be possible without Afghanistan as a base for operations. We could not have succeeded in getting Osama bin Laden a year ago May if we hadn't been able to fly out of Jalalabad. If those SEALs had flown off of a carrier in the Arabian Peninsula, the mission would have been a catastrophic failure when the first helicopter crashed on a hard landing. Secondly, I think the leaders will be able to note that NATO's surge in troops over the course of the last 3 years has succeeded in halting the Taliban's momentum. The Taliban, for the better part of 5 years, was steadily getting stronger, steadily proving ability to carry out attacks through more and more of Afghanistan. That, I think, is no longer the case. The 43 allies that have troops on the ground in Afghanistan, which is the largest military alliance in history, has finally succeeded in stemming the Taliban's advance. Third, I think they can point to the success in building up an Afghan security force, now roughly 350,000 strong, more than double what it was 3 years ago. This force is now big enough and I think by all measures good enough to be able to contain the Taliban threat without significant numbers of foreign combat forces after 2014. That's a substantial success as well. There are many, many problems in Afghanistan that will not be resolved between now and 2014. Corruption, drugs, you name it. Anyone who thought they could be resolved by 2014 was living in a fantasy world. But what is necessary, essential, for the alliance that went in there will be accomplished by 2014. And we have now a viable exit plan to get out, as long as we do it cautiously and carefully. If that exit plan is implemented with care, we will be able to turn over in Afghanistan in 2014, which meets the alliance's minimum needs. We need to be very careful to avoid a rush to the exit, and I think that the new French president can expect to be ganged up on by everyone else at NATO to urge him not to rush to the exit. He'll find out in any case that it's very difficult to rush to the exit in Afghanistan, because if the Pakistanis won't let you out, you have to leave your kit behind. Since their kit is the best they've got in the entire French military, they'll be pretty reluctant to do that. The post-2014 Afghanistan, as I said, is not going to look like Nirvana nor Valhalla. The civil war will almost certainly continue between the government and the Taliban, but the government will be able to maintain its control of Kabul and other major cities, and it will be able to enforce its writ when it wants to in substantial parts of the north and center of the country. We will also have an Afghanistan which will have somewhere between 8 and 10 million children going to school, half of them girls. That is a substantial change from the Afghanistan that we went into in 2001. The Afghan National Security Forces will need to be funded by the outside, roughly $4 billion a year. That's roughly the equivalent of what the United States has provided Israel and Egypt for the last 35 years. So it is something that we are currently capable of doing. I think a lot of conversation in Chicago will be about trying to make people pledge future contributions to this. I suspect that there'll be a lot of promises, but I don't think there'll be very many checks in the mail so far. The vital outcome of the exit plan has already been previewed in President Obama's trip to Kabul last month, and the deal has been basically reached for a long-term U.S. strategic relationship with Afghanistan that allows us to continue to retain base access to bases in Afghanistan to carry out counterterrorist missions, both in Afghanistan and, of course, next door in Pakistan as well. All of this could become substantially better if the government of Pakistan cooperates with the mission in ways that it has failed to do so far. Pakistan has been critical to the revival of the Taliban. Without Pakistan's sanctuaries, safe havens, and fundraising, the Taliban would never have been able to recover from the blows inflicted on it in 2001 and 2002. Without Pakistani sanctuaries and safe haven today, the Taliban would be a much diminished force. The Pakistanis have full control physically over the senior leadership of the Taliban and their families, a tremendous capacity to influence what they want to do. I think there is much truth to the argument that NATO is in many ways fighting a proxy war already with Pakistan and has been for the last 5 or 6 years. Pakistan is, of course, also today home to 3 of the 5 most wanted on America's most wanted terrorism list. Only one of those 3, Ayman Zawahiri, bin Laden's successor, is actually hiding in Pakistan. The other 2 aren't hiding at all. Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, resides in Karachi. The government of Pakistan meets with him on a regular basis. And Hafez Saeed, the leader of Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that attacked Mumbai 3 years ago, doesn't hide at all. He appears on Pakistani television almost every night and hangs out at large rallies in Pakistani cities, usually sponsored by the Pakistani intelligence services. That's a bleak picture, but I think there is a few rays of hope in Pakistan today, things that we haven't seen in the last several months. There is evidence of some rethinking on the part of the government of Pakistan about its policies. The first and most dramatic piece of evidence of that was President Zardari's trip to India just over a month ago now. President Zardari has long been a supporter of trying to find a rapprochement between India and Pakistan. His efforts in that regard were, of course, sabotaged by the attack on Mumbai in November 2008, but he now seems determined to try to restart them. His thinking on this is driven largely by economics. Pakistan realizes that if it's going to have a brighter economic future, it has to tie its cart to the Indian economy. And the good news is the Indians are quite eager to have Pakistan do that as long as it starts to take some moves against terrorists like Hafez Saeed. This could easily be derailed if Lashkar-e-Taiba carries out another large-scale spectacular mass casualty attack in India. But hopefully the ISI will now be taking steps to ensure that that at least doesn't happen, even if they don't bring Mr. Saeed to justice. This, I would stress, is the biggest game changer in the subcontinent. Rapprochement between India and Pakistan has the potential to really bring the subcontinent to Nirvana or Valhalla or wherever you want to take it. This second major step is underway now. President Zardari has agreed to come to Chicago to represent Pakistan at the NATO summit. This is a fundamental change from the government of Pakistan's previous policy. They avoided the last major summit in Bonn and found themselves isolated. Pakistanis, I think, also have realized that their boycott closure of the ground transportation links for NATO logistics into Afghanistan has proven to be a failure. They did not bring the NATO alliance to its knees. They did put a pretty big hole in the NATO alliance's pocketbook, since everything that comes in through the northern route costs at least three, in some cases six times as much as if it comes in through Karachi. But the Pakistanis were also big losers, since they made a lot of money on providing logistics support through their ports and through their tanker traffic. There's a pretty good chance that Pakistan will reopen the border sometime in the next 24 to 48 hours. If Pakistan was prepared to go one step further and use its influence with the Afghan Taliban to push them back into a political process, to get them back into talks in Doha, first with us and then also with the Afghan government directly, that could change the outlook in Afghanistan considerably for the better. A political process between the Taliban leadership and the Karzai government is the most likely way to find a positive outcome in Afghanistan that brings the civil war finally to an end. Remains to be seen whether the government of Pakistan is willing to go that far. President Zardari probably is. It's not clear whether he can get the army and the ISI to come along with him. In all of this, the NATO allies and the G8 in particular could play a very significant and important role. The degree to which the G8 can encourage Pakistan to play a more responsible role in Afghanistan and in the subcontinent in particular could be very, very important. China and Saudi Arabia, of course, could bring a lot more influence on the Pakistanis than anyone else. But there is room here for indirect diplomacy for the allies to try to see if they can find a way to encourage China and Saudi Arabia, to encourage Pakistan to do the right thing and to move forward. So I think on Afghanistan, the summit in Chicago will be generally a good news story. I don't expect it to make a lot of headlines. On Pakistan, there's reason for hope after a long winter in which there wasn't much reason for hope. Thank you.
I'm actually rather stunned that ended on an optimistic note given the topic, but you held true. Suzanne, I hope you continue the optimism in your remarks on Iran.
Well, thank you, Dan, and thank you to Bruce and the Managing Global Order Project for inviting us here today to bring a Middle East dimension to the discussion of the G8 and NATO. I think Bruce actually left me with a very nice segue which is to say that, you know, for the moment at least, there appears to be at least a small amount of hope with respect to Iran after a very long winter in which almost every conversation seemed to begin or end with a projection of when the Israelis and or the Americans might feel compelled to strike the Iranian nuclear program. Rather than a good news story, though, for the meetings this week, I think Iran is very much a wait-and-see story because we are obviously on the eve of the next round of formal talks between the P5 plus one and Iranian representatives, which are scheduled to take place a week from today in Baghdad. Those talks and the technical discussions that are occurring between Iranians and representatives of the EU this week and over the course of weeks since the initial meeting last month between the P5 plus one and Iran are the subject of obviously a great deal of uncertainty, but at least some degree of expectation on all sides. The last round of dialogue ended almost shockingly amidst very warm comments from both sides. The Iranians, not simply in the remarks of the nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili in the press conferences that he gave in the aftermath of those talks in Istanbul, but also in the continuing press dialogue, which is one of the few ways we have of monitoring at least a lead opinion and dialogue and discourse on the nuclear program from a distance here in Washington. There has been an almost effusive reaction to what happened in Istanbul, a sense that, at least from the Iranian perspective, that they are heavily invested in this process, that they see a means of spinning whatever outcome may come of it in a way that is that supports their own narrative of having preserved their rights and having pushed back efforts by Washington in particular and other American allies to strip Iran of its nuclear program and, in particular, its right to enrichment. And so you have heard, surprisingly, a similarly positive, although obviously a different substance to the narrative here in Washington as well as from others who participated in that process. And we have not seen what is typical in these sorts of discussions, a sort of rewriting of the narrative as everyone, as the time, the distance between the negotiating table and the press conferences increases. In fact, there's been a fairly consistent message coming out of the State Department, coming out of the administration, echoed, I think, by EU negotiators and at least not contradicted so far by those speaking from the Russian and Chinese perspectives, that suggests that there is an expectation that it is going to be possible to obtain some early concrete evidence of progress on the Iranian nuclear issue. This would, of course, be the first evidence thereof since the outset of the Obama administration. The expectation is this progress will revolve around the issue of Iran's continuing enrichment of higher levels, up to 20% enrichment or nearly 20% enrichment, as a means of providing fuel for a research reactor that produces medical isotopes for treatment of cancer patients in Iran. It is, of course, a reactor that was initially funded and supplied by the United States during the pre-revolutionary era. And it is a reactor that has been the subject of persistent efforts, first by the P5 plus one, belatedly a year later by the Brazilians and the Turks, to create a kind of confidence-building measure opportunity here, something that would not, in fact, resolve the root issue of concern about Iran's nuclear activities, but would at least be a starting point for cooperation and potentially for trust-building among both sides. Once again, we are back to this issue of the research reactor, and there is an expectation, because the Iranians have been signaling in the most direct fashion possible for at least 6 or 8 months, that they are, in fact, possibly prepared to deal on this issue, possibly prepared to halt their higher-level enrichment, possibly even ship out their stockpile of higher-enriched uranium in a way that would at least support some sort of an ongoing process of mutual concessions. The difficulty, of course, is in this atmosphere of optimism, before I leave you with any sense that, in fact, Iran is at this stage very conclusively a good news story, there is a great deal that can throw this process off. first and foremost, politics goes on in Tehran. It goes on here. And it goes on, of course, as you all know, in Europe, in Russia, and in China. Much has happened even in the span of weeks since those initial meetings in Istanbul. And much has changed. And at every stage, there is the potential that one side or the other will get cold feet. Even the reports yesterday that the State Department may be considering delisting the Mojahedin-e-Khalq as a foreign terrorist organization, which is a process which is entirely distinct from the nuclear negotiations and has no direct connections, will be perceived on the Iranian part as potentially an aggressive move and a cause for reprisals and potentially a loss of whatever trust is beginning to be built up. The second issue is that, you know, these new political actors, the shifts in the politics of Russia, of France, and other players are inevitably going to alter the decision-making dynamics within the P5+1. We have yet to see how President Hollande will differ on Iran in his decision-making and in his diplomacy from President Sarkozy, who is obviously an extremely active and assertive component of the diplomacy on Iran for the past several years. That is going to be an important factor, if not for these upcoming talks, certainly for the decisions about where to proceed from here. We have a third issue, which is we are on the verge of implementing fully two sets of very severe sanctions, potentially the most severe sanctions Iran has ever faced, and on par with the most severe sanctions that any country around the world has faced. These are the measures that target Iran's central bank, implemented, signed by President Obama late last year, set to be fully implemented because of a six-month waiting period for state businesses or state financial institutions that did business with the central bank as of July 1st. And the same approximate implementation date for an EU embargo, which would not simply affect the European importation of Iranian crude, but would also have a very drastic and potentially catastrophic impact on Iran's ability to export crude anywhere around the world because of the implications for insuring tankers that would dock anywhere in any port of call. These, of course, are playing out in a situation of tremendous fragility of the European economy, real questions about the political directions of Greece. And these sanctions, for the first time, have begun to expose some rifts in strategy and in preferences among the P5+1. Obviously, this has never been a fully unified coalition, but it has been remarkably effective and coordinated over the course of the past 3 years, even at particular points of stress, whether it was the Iranian election upheaval, whether it was the failed process of confidence building in October and November of 2009. And since then, we have seen a remarkable degree of coherence, particularly between Russia, China, and the United States. These new sanctions have the potential to really rip that right open because the Russians and Chinese have been very explicit in their opposition to the new measures, the reach and the breadth of these new measures. And for that reason, I think we're entering potentially a new period of diplomacy, even within the P5+1 on Iran. Finally, just to fully cast a doubt on the process that will take place next week, I think it's important to remember that there are really no guarantees that a successful confidence-building measure, even if we're able to get to that point next week, even if we are able to get some sort of initial gesture on the part of the Iranians, there's simply no guarantees that it is going to create an ongoing process of trust building and an ongoing process of dialogue which can conclusively deal with the root issue of the concern about Iran's nuclear program. Ultimately, Iran is very clear about its unwillingness to give up its enrichment capabilities, and to date, at least, the coalition and in particular some of America's allies have been very clear on the issue that enrichment must be stopped. And, of course, we are in a political year here in Washington, a year in which the Congress is actively trying to intervene and effectively set new red lines for American diplomacy, including new red lines that might restrict the Obama administration's diplomatic flexibility. Let me just say, if we do pass the hurdle of next week, if we do in fact see something come out of these discussions on Iran in terms of an initial gesture, either next week or in the weeks to come, because I think the administration has tried to be clear that in fact they don't see Baghdad as sort of the beginning or end of anything. There are some outstanding questions that I think really need to be dealt with by the international community about how to deal with Iran. First and foremost is this whole issue of approach. There are a couple of drastic alternatives. One is incrementalism, which is what we've been trying to do and what I think you see in this discussion of confidence-building measures. The difficulty with that is that ultimately no Iranian leadership will ever trust Washington. It is simply not part of their ideological worldview, and their paranoia and suspicions are probably well justified. And so our ability to create a durable process of trust is probably quite limited, and as a result, incrementalism is going to be very difficult to sustain. But the other alternative, a grand bargain, is, I think, equally quixotic, if not more so. And so what is it that we can create in between this destabilizing and difficult process of incrementalism and one that might, in fact, and the offer of a grand bargain, which is purely illusory, that might create some prospect for progress? The second big issue is red lines, and of course this gets to the question of enrichment. It gets to the debate within the U.S. political sphere as well as the differences among potentially Washington and its allies and Washington and the rest of the P5 plus one. How is it that we can articulate and more importantly enforce very clear red lines to constrain Iran's nuclear progress? And how is it that we can get the rest of the P5 plus one to buy into whatever red lines are ultimately essential from the American point of view? Third issue, I think, is deterrence. I mean, there's been a lot of threats exchanged on all sides over the course of the past 6 months. But in effect, it's not terribly clear to me that the prospect or the possibility of an Israeli strike motivates Iran to negotiate in a more serious fashion. It's arguable, I think, that it actually empowers hardliners, that it, in fact, provokes the Iranian regime in a way that is not terribly useful to negotiations. How is it that we can effectively deter Iran? Fourth issue is the efficacy of sanctions. We have persistently overstated expectations of sanctions. We have heard time and again about Iran's Achilles heel. First it was refined petroleum, now it is the central bank sanctions. It's not clear to me that there are low-cost, high-impact solutions to the Iranian nuclear program in an environment of robust energy demand, of growing economies. It is going to be very difficult to see much or all of Iran's 2 or 2.25 million barrels a day knocked off the market. The market has absorbed the loss of about 300,000 barrels a day over the course of the past few months, but we're talking about a much bigger magnitude potentially after July. Fifth is, how do we move beyond the nuclear issue? And I'm reminded of the fact that last time Brookings did an event on Iran here at Carnegie in cooperation with Carnegie and Woodrow Wilson, it was focused on human rights and democracy. And in fact, these are at least as essential to our differences with Iran as the nuclear program. How can the international community, given the differences on democracy and all of these issues, even among the P5 plus one, much less among NATO and the G8, how can we, in effect, put issues beyond the nuclear issue on the table with Iran? Finally, I think the international community, the G8, need to think very hard about this question of multilateralism. Iran could be this incredible success case for multilateralism. If the negotiations succeed, and by that I mean if we are able to prevent either a nuclear Iran or a strike against Iran's nuclear program, I think we would have, sort of this new model of how the international community can come together, not just through the P5 plus one, not just through this negotiating mechanism, but through the kind of coordination and cooperation that we've seen on among the international community much more widely on the implementation of sanctions. It's notable that the first time that that Washington tried to implement third-party extraterritorial sanctions on Iran in the 1990s when Bruce was in the White House, there was an incredible amount of pushback, even from our closest allies in Europe. Over the course of the past decade, we have found ways to bring the entire international community on board with measures that penalize individual Iranian financial entities as well as individual institutions and officials in Iran in a very, very effective way. And this has worked incredibly well. And if and when we come to a diplomatic resolution of the Iranian nuclear program, that kind of coordination, the reach of measures that were determined and passed here in Washington but actively participated in by the international community will deserve a lot of the credit. How can we replicate this? Is this a model beyond Iran that can be used? However, I think the converse is true. If the Iranian negotiations fail, then we have failed. The international community has failed this kind of test case for coming together and solving pressing national security and economic issues. And the outcome, not just for regional security, not just for American interests in the Middle East, not just for the global economy, which was, of course, the precipitating conditions for the initial convening of the G8 30 years ago, will be in tremendous concern. But also, I think this whole question of the issue of the major powers working together cooperatively becomes much, much more difficult for the future. With that, I'll turn it back to Dan.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Before I open it up, I wanted to ask both of you to comment briefly on a huge issue that I think is very relevant to our panel, which is the dramatic transformation within the Arab world. As everyone here knows, for the last really year and a half, we've seen many of the traditional issues facing the Arab world turned on their head, with dramatic regime changes, instability, civil war, and really many people believe that we're seeing the birth of a new order in the region. And this, of course, has profound implications not only for the peoples there and their governments, but also for outside powers, the United States, G8 countries, Europe more broadly. And again, these interests are not always the same and not always in the same priority level, but still very important. And I would welcome both of you to comment on what this means for the region, for other countries, from your perspectives. Bruce, if I can ask you again.
Sure. Keeping with my relentlessly optimistic posture today, let's look at the good news. I think there is significant good news, and it starts in Egypt. Egypt is on the verge of doing something it has never done in 5,000 years, having a democratically elected government. That is a big, big step for the largest Arab state. It's already successfully elected a parliament, and I think there's every reason to believe it will soon elect a president. It's also, I think, reasonable to assume that the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty is going to remain intact. Fears that that treaty was going to be lost in the Egyptian revolution, I think, have proven to be exaggerated. That's not to say that the new Egyptian government, probably or possibly led by Amr Moussa, is going to like Israel. I think Mr. Moussa has made it clear over the years that's not in the cards. But I think it is a government that is going to be determined to continue to maintain a vestige of peace between Israel and Egypt, and that is, of course, the cornerstone of all of our hopes for an Arab-Israeli peace agreement. I think that the G8 has a unique opportunity in the next months ahead to help this Egyptian experiment, to encourage the Egyptian army, now having successfully carried out its duty, to go back to the barracks and get out of the political process. This is a delicate process, but we have means to help encourage the Egyptian army to do that. U.S. assistance in particular has already proven to be very effective leverage in moving the Egyptian army in the right direction. What Egypt needs is, of course, money, economic assistance. That's not in the pipeline. I don't see any of the G8 countries in a position to provide significant economic assistance to Egypt in the foreseeable future. But they can certainly try to encourage a return to robust tourism to Egypt, which is critical to the survival of the Egyptian economy. The other piece of good news, I think, for Egypt and for the entire Arab Spring is that there is a clear role model for how to proceed, and that's the Turkish role model, which has demonstrated that an Islamist government can provide not only more accountability and the rule of law in government, not perfect, but a lot more than in the past, but it can also provide for robust economic growth. Less good news, obviously, in Yemen and Libya, but both of those countries, after a very, very difficult transition period, seem to be moving towards some kind of revived central government. They both got a long, long way to go. Yemen, in particular, has essentially lost control of both its northern provinces and its southern provinces, and the gap, the hole is being filled in the south, at least by al-Qaeda. Something like that may be starting to happen in eastern Libya now, too, as well. But compared to where they were 3 or 4 months ago, both Yemen and Libya are at least moving on the right trajectory. Then we get to the no good news story, and I think there's two no good news stories. First, Syria. Syria is descending into what is going to be a truly awful sectarian civil war. I think we've barely begun to see how bad this is going to get. There's very little room for compromise between the Alawis and the Sunnis. The notion of some kind of political compromise between the Assad government and the opposition, I think, is very, very, very hard to imagine. This Syrian situation, we're also seeing al-Qaeda moving into the disorder and the chaos, and I think we're probably, unfortunately, going to see more of that. The other bad news about the Syrian situation is spillover. We're already starting to see it in Lebanon, and I think there's a good chance it's going to get worse in Lebanon. Lebanon's second city, Tripoli, is already showing signs of fracturing on sectarian grounds. And we all should remember that Lebanon, once it falls into civil war, is likely to stick in civil war for at least a decade or two. At least that's Lebanon's past practice. The other place where there's no good news is Bahrain. The Saudi intervention in Bahrain has frozen another very ugly sectarian situation, which is radicalizing as well. And the Saudi talk in the last couple of weeks about forming a more closer political union between Saudi Arabia and the other states of the GCC appears to be in little more than a cover for finding a way to perpetuate the Saudi occupation of Bahrain for the indefinite future. That's an outcome that is not a step forward. That's a big step backwards. So it's a mixed picture. I'm sure that the G8 will spend more time talking about the hard problems, Syria, than they will about some of the others. But I think that the place where we can probably make the biggest difference is actually in Egypt, in trying to ensure that the transition there is one that moves in the end to democracy and to some degree of prosperity. If we can get Egypt right, that would be a huge change in the Middle East in a positive direction.
I'll only comment briefly because I think Bruce has given a fantastic tour of the horizon, and I agree with everything he had to say. I just want to echo sort of two broad points. One is this issue of sectarianism, which you heard him reference with respect to the Syrian civil war and how it spills over into Lebanon and elsewhere, as well as with respect to the Gulf. And I think this is an enormously important issue that needs to be dealt with on an international basis. We are facing, a new Cold War emerging in an area of the world that is vital to the global economy. And it is one that is too easy to ignore or too easy to sort of compartmentalize into specific state crises. But even if and as we come to some sort of a resolution of each of these individual problems, this broader division between Sunni and Shia, this broader sense of crisis and conflict that I think is beginning to infect the entire region in a way that is only on par with the height of the Iraqi civil war, and perhaps even, I would argue, more dramatic and of much broader concern today than it was then. something that we have to grapple with, and we have to begin to find a way to undercut rather than to exacerbate by virtue of our own actions. The second issue is energy. Of course, gasoline prices have dipped a bit. Everybody is a bit calmer today than they perhaps were in January, February, when the initial run-up or most recent run-up occurred. But I think we're in a period of tremendous flux for global energy markets. And again, hearkening back to the sort of inceptions of the G8, this whole issue of the global supply-demand balance, how the changing picture of energy is going to play into the changing security dimensions is something that really needs to be dealt with. In all of this, we have some specific questions and decisions. You know, NATO inevitably has to be thinking about what role it's going to play in a Gulf that may be threatened by a nuclear Iran. And how to play that role in a way that doesn't exacerbate either our energy security concerns or the problem of sectarianism needs to be thought through very carefully.
I'd like to open it up for questions. If I can ask you to wait for the microphone before you give your question, also please to state your name and affiliation. And sir, in the front row.
Daniele Moro, Johns Hopkins Center for Transatlantic Relations. My question is, many people after the fall of Gaddafi said, you see, the West attacked Gaddafi because he gave up nuclear bacteriological. And the question is, why the Iranian, which, by the way, also on the opposition, don't have any difference inside in saying we will go on in some way? Why they should give up the nuclear? In your opinion?
Certainly the specter of Libya doesn't assist us with trying to persuade Iran that there is a prospect of denuclearizing without seeing a violent and violent end of the regime in the midst of international intervention. But of course there are equally compelling examples of countries like South Africa and Brazil that have in fact made different decisions or made the same decision but come to a much more successful end. So I don't think the precedent of Libya is tremendously influential in terms of shaping Iran's perspective. If anything, Iran's security priorities have been dictated by, you know, three decades of antagonism with all of its neighbors as well as with the world's major power and the global economy's major power. And so for that reason, you know, this is endemic to the way that they see the world, and their perception that they need a nuclear deterrent, I think, is one that is very deep-seated and is going to be very, very difficult to wean them away from. And this makes all of these interim measures, whatever sort of steps we can find to constrain the program, that much more important as unoptimistic, I don't know, I don't want to say pessimistic, as I think realistic as I am about the prospect of coming to a firm resolution. I think measures, interim measures that have some value in knocking back Iran's program and turning back the clock a little bit or at least preventing them from advancing any further have real value, even if ultimately it doesn't solve the problem for us. If we could have sustained the EU3's embargo or the EU3's suspension that was in place for 2 years in the early part of this decade, I think there would have been that obviously would have been a much more preferential outcome. So we have to be careful not to let the perfect be the enemy of the good, not to presume that there's no progress that can be made, even if and as the Iranians are probably unreceptive to any permanent resolution.
Yes, sir.
My name is Dick Krikas, Mary Washington University. My question for both speakers is framed against the backdrop that many people would argue that if we have a final solution to Afghanistan, it has to include all the stakeholders. You mentioned, Bruce, Pakistan, absolutely the most critical one, but we also have Russia, China, India, Saudi Arabia, etc. But we also have Iran. And first of all, when I asked Bruce, would you agree that no final solution is possible beyond 2014 without participation, active participation of all of these stakeholders. And then for Susan, the question is, if we could make some progress with Iran on the nuclear issue, in spite of all the problems that you pointed out, and it's very difficult, could we also find Iran being helpful in resolving the Afghanistan question as a major stakeholder in that crisis?
There are two likely outcomes in Afghanistan after 2014. There's the one that I call the de minimis outcome, which is there is no political process and the civil war continues. That's the one that looks most likely right now. The Taliban have suspended participation in negotiations and seem to be killing Afghan negotiators rather than looking to talk to them. What I tried to suggest in my opening remarks is we can probably live with that outcome with what we've done in the course of the last 3 years in building up the Afghan army. There is, of course, a much better solution, which is the one you're hinting at, which is a political process, and you're absolutely right. For the political process to work, the regional stakeholders have to be active participants in that. Pakistan is the most important. You mentioned the other ones who count as well. The good news so far in this war, and it's now, it predates 2001, it actually goes back to the late 1990s, is that the government of Iran has generally been a positive and benign player in the Afghan civil war. They support the Karzai government. They have connections with the Taliban, carefully built connections with the Taliban as a hedge against the future. But by and large, Iran has been a positive player. The most economically prosperous part of Afghanistan today is the area around the city of Herat in western Afghanistan, which is linked to the Iranian electrical power grid and where Iran provides an awful lot of the economic activity that makes Herat probably the safest city in all of Afghanistan to live in. Now, there's also a very interesting connection between the Iranians and the Indians. India has built a major new highway that links Afghanistan's ring road to the Iranian highway system, which means for the first time in its history, Afghanistan has an alternative outlet to the sea other than Karachi. And it is now in the business of building a railroad that will go along the same geographic corridor as the highway. And that $1 trillion in stuff that's underneath the mountains of Afghanistan is going to get to the world through an Indian highway and an Indian railroad that goes through Iran. For the Indians, this is, of course, a double header. It's not only good economic policy, good economic support for Afghanistan, it also drives the Pakistanis absolutely berserk. And in India, anything that does two things like that at the same time has got to be all good.
I work for the French newspaper, Libération. A question on Syria. How do you see the U.S. administration evolving on Syria, and what could, what can the U.S. do, and what should they do?
I think I will shamelessly field that one myself. What's interesting to see is if you look at U.S. policy on a day-to-day basis, you see a reluctance to escalate. You see a tremendous concern that the situation in Syria is going to overwhelm other U.S. initiatives in the region and overwhelm broader U.S. policy concerns. If you step back, though, and look at U.S. policy, and I would say more broadly Western policy, in three-month increments, if you will, you actually see a steady escalation. There was initially, I think, a strong effort to avoid this issue. Then there was rhetorical pressure. Then there was significant rhetorical and economic pressure. Then there was more reach out to the opposition. There's humanitarian aid to the opposition. And now there's, I would not say cooperation, maybe too strong a word, but certainly tacit cooperation with allies that are providing quite significant arms to the Syrian opposition. So we're seeing steady escalation at the same time as I think there's a desire to avoid having the American hand be forced in this issue. I would say until about 5-6 months ago, the assumption was that Bashar al-Assad was going to fall. So in a way, this problem would be taken care of. From a policy point of view, however, it's become in some ways a standoff, which is the worst of all worlds, that the government is too weak to win and the opposition is too weak to overthrow the government. So it's a lingering crisis, but as Bruce pointed out in, I think, his accurate but very scary remarks, it's one that threatens to really engulf the region. And as Suzanne said, it's one that, with the sectarian overtones, really could almost hijack much of what's going on positively in the region in the last year and really reshape the dynamic. So I think there's concern about that, but there's no desire in the American government, in the American bureaucracies, especially the Department of Defense, for a very aggressive American effort. I would say in the European powers, Libya was their last effort. What's happening on a daily basis in Greece is going to overwhelm any thought in European capitals about getting involved aggressively in the Middle East. And Turkey has been reluctant to be pushing very hard against Syria and has been looking for strong support from the United States for a more aggressive policy, and that is not forthcoming. So I think it's very much a backing into a more escalatory approach, but I think there will be a strong effort to try to limit the degree of U.S. exposure in this.
Thanks. I'm Ken Yates with Jefferson Waterman International. Bruce, the area of Afghanistan you left out in your description was the southwest, where the major problem is it's the homeland of the Taliban. If that region of the country is to prosper, the only thing it's going to be is agricultural. But it also can't get out of the country, hasn't traditionally been able to get out of the country with its produce. To the Gulf, their route would naturally go through Quetta and through what is now Balochistan. But the Baloch are a problem for the PACs. It's a very complicated situation down there, but if that region becomes prosperous, how do you see the problem for Pakistan evolving with Balochistan? What happens to that part of that country? It's a major portion of the country.
Absolutely. Balochistan is where Pakistan's future probably is, where the natural resources exist that could make prosperous Pakistan. The government of Pakistan today regards Balochistan as basically occupied territory. It's not new. The Zardari government is not the first Pakistani government to look at the Balochistan that way. This is a long, well-established process. The only hope that I would offer you in that direction is that the Zardari government, with all of its faults, looks to be likely to be the first Pakistani government to actually fill out its term in office without a military coup or an assassination of the leader or extra-constitutional moves. That may not sound like a big accomplishment, but in Pakistani terms, that's a pretty big accomplishment. President Zardari, who gets a lot of bad press and deserves a fair amount of it, should also get some credit for the fact that he has moved the political process in Pakistan in the right direction. I think there is a reasonable chance that his government will be reelected if there are free and fair elections in 2013. And I would hope that a second term Zardari government would begin to rethink the Baloch problem and try to move away from the solution is repression to a political process that tries to bring in a more representative Baloch outcome. I'm you know, that's my hope. I don't have any firm evidence to point in that direction, other than the fact that President Zardari is fundamentally interested in one thing, making money. And he knows that the way to make money is not through war, but through peace and economic expansion. That's why he wants to do it with India. And I would hope that in time, the civilian side of the Pakistani government, as it gets strength, will try to bring about Pakistani, both foreign and domestic policies, which are oriented in the long-term direction of prosperous future for Pakistanis, rather than the direction that the Pakistani governments of the past have seemed to be preoccupied with, which is building the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world.
Bruce. Thanks. Bruce Jones from the Managing Global Order Project at Brookings. One of the things we discussed with Mike Froman in the first panel was the tension, in a sense, between the positive aspect of the G8 as a small club of like-minded Western states, exception of Russia, working together and deepening the habit of working together to solve problems. And on the other hand, that there are other major actors out there who have significant stakes in a range of the issues, including the ones that you've been discussing. So I just wonder if you could comment a little bit about the interaction between the G8 and NATO, Western players on the one hand, and some of the others. I mean, you've touched on India in Afghanistan, but it'd be interesting to hear more on India. Turkey, obviously, on both sets of issues, and China, on all these. So all these actors who have major stakes and their own forms of influence, and I'd be interested to know more about the interaction between the West and those actors.
I will at least start by saying I think China is the most important actor on Iran today. There is no solution to the Iranian nuclear program that does not involve effective coordination from China. India is still a major purchaser of Iranian crude, and in many ways has tied itself more directly to the continuation of the Iranian state, because it is now paying for that crude in rupees, and therefore, you know, sort of Iran is now engaged in wide-ranging barter trade with both India and China. But, you know, and thus far I think it's been relatively successful. This has been, you know, these have been delicate negotiations. You saw Secretary Clinton in India last week talking about this issue of crude purchases and bringing the Indians on board more cooperatively with the question, with the new sanctions. But it ultimately, there are also different interests. There are divergences in the perspectives on how effective sanctions can be in changing something as significant as an investment in a nuclear program. And, of course, the historical experience of the Chinese with sanctions not even all that long ago makes them very acutely sensitive to the reliance of the international community on sanctions to bring Iran along on the nuclear program. So, I think that's why we're at this kind of key turning point. If, in fact, we see the sanctions implemented in a way that is not terribly destructive to either the global economy or to the relatively strong cooperation that we've had so far on a very multilateral basis on Iran, then I think, you know, that will be quite positive. It will also mean that we will not have implemented the sanctions in the most robust fashion as possible. Iran may have been preserved from the most drastic impacts of the sanctions. But ultimately, I think the greater good will be this international approach, because the Iranians have begun to entirely formulate their approach to the world by looking east. They are fully convinced, and I think this extends far beyond even the ideologues in the regime at this stage, that their future lies to the east, that trade and investment from Asia and India is going to be essential for their future growth. And they're fully prepared to lose a relationship with Europe, which has been central to Iran's history. You know, the sort of missing player in all of this is Russia. Russia has had this traditionally very strong relationship at both an economic and an elite political level with with the Iranians, and I think they still do cast a large shadow. But really, it's a minuscule importance compared to the amount of trade and investment that is conducted between the Iranians and the Chinese and the Indians.
I would just comment on one part, which you talked about Turkey, and if thinking about this part of the world, the importance of Turkey cannot be underestimated. For the better part of a century, the Turks did not play anymore. The post-Ottoman Turkish foreign policy precluded any real involvement in the affairs of the broader Middle East. That has changed, and I think it is a change for the better, a significant change for the better. Not only is Turkey a tremendous role model with its imperfections, I'm not here to boost Turkish tourism, but as a role model, it really is an impressive example. And then more than that, it's the key to the Syrian question. It is inconceivable that there's going to be significant international involvement in trying to find a solution to the Syrian problem without Turkish support. Turkey has to be the base from which any kind of significant peacekeeping, humanitarian, boots on the ground, you name it, it's all going to come out of Turkey. And here I think the Turks are probably, really thinking long and hard about how much more they want to get involved in what could be an open-ended, long-term process. They provided the base for a very effective humanitarian operation in Iraq in the 1990s, Operation Provide Comfort. And what did Turkey get out of that? A de facto Kurdish mini-state on its border, which is the nightmare of every Turkish diplomat and general. I don't think it wants to see something like that happen on the Syrian side. Doesn't have to be like that, though. There are other conceivable outcomes, and I think that the G8 would be wise to be thinking about an even higher integration with Turkey, and I think the NATO allies really need to be making the Turks feel very welcome, very much at home, and very much part of the inner core of decision-making of the NATO alliance from now on.
My name is Ahmed. I'm a student. My question was, this weekend's NATO summit, Israel is going to be conspicuously absent from the summit as opposed to other members of the Mediterranean dialogue, like Jordan and another country, Pakistan, going to be there. What should we make of Israel's absence, and do you believe what the commentators are suggesting, that Turkey played a role in keeping Israel out of it because of the flotilla incident in 2010?
I don't know the inside scoop, so I can't help you there. I'll say this. I suspect there will be a lot of conversation, not on the agenda, but on the margins, both at NATO and even more at the G8, about Israel and about getting the Israeli-Palestinian political process moving in 2013. I can't think of anything that would do more to make the outcome of the Arab Spring positive outcome than to get the Israeli-Palestinian peace process moving forward in a robust and dramatic way. We've been told for the last several years that there is no political party, no political partner on the Israeli side. Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu has now given us a partner. He is ready. He's got the political base. Now is the time, Mr. Prime Minister, to get serious about negotiations with the Palestinians. I'm not going to hold my breath, but I think that the G8 can come next January, should be prepared to come down like a load of bricks on Israelis and Palestinians to move forward.
If I understand correctly, all of these major Middle East issues, Iran, Syria, and Afghanistan will be on the agenda in both summits. First of all, I wasn't really clear. There will be talked about. And then in concrete terms, I mean, what I got out of your talk, Mr. Riddell, is that there will be a request for commitments to economic aid for Afghanistan. There will be pressure on President Zardari to be more cooperative. There will be pressure on François Hollande not to try to pull out next year, or this year, I think he promised. Are there any other sort of concrete things that could come out of it? And also with Syria, I mean, you seem to be saying, Mr. Byman, did I get it? Yeah, that basically nobody wants to get involved, but there must be some kind of options. I mean, what? And finally, with Iran, I just want to make sure I understood the thing about the research reactor. Is this basically a confidence-building measure that the P5+1 would allow them to keep that reactor and the Iranians could use it as sort of propaganda and say, we're continuing enrichment? I mean, I didn't really understand the mechanism. And that wouldn't in any way forestall the sanctions taking effect on the 1st of July, would it? Thank you.
There's a lot there. I will say briefly to limit my colleagues a bit. We were asked to present on kind of issues in the region of relevance to the G8. I don't think any of us are claiming kind of an in-depth knowledge of especially the internal agenda as beyond the kind of press releases and so on of what actually will be the priorities. And as you know, this is often determined relatively at the last minute in terms of what sucks up the most attention, just given crises appear and so on. But the issues we've discussed, we're fairly confident will be discussed in some format, in some way, by if you look at NATO and if you look at the G8 efforts. I'll talk very briefly on Syria before passing it on to my colleagues. Certainly, Syria options are on the table. Events in Syria are forcing options to be on the table. The big question right now concerns the Syrian opposition. The Annan plan, I think everyone, including Annan, agrees it's failed. So that was seen by many people who were skeptical as basically it can't hurt to give diplomacy a chance. The cost is low. Diplomacy had its chance. So the question is, what do you do next? Do you ignore it? Do you contain it? Or do you try to escalate in various ways to push Assad out? And all those different options are being discussed. And all of them are being discussed, however, in the sense of how can change be affected, but the cost and the exposure be kept limited. States in the region, outside powers, are very concerned about being sucked in into an interminable effort that may not produce positive results. But at the same time, there's a reluctance to simply abandon the Syrian people and the Syrian opposition to the depredations of the regime.
On Iran, let me just be clear on the possibility of a confidence-building measure. I think, and the administration has effectively said, that they are putting a wide range of different possibilities on the table. They are looking for something that will bring the Iranians into what would ideally be a long-term process of dialogue that would involve specific concessions. They want to see concrete progress, I think is the phrase that they keep using ad nauseum. The 20% enrichment issue is one that has sort of captivated attention because the Iranians have been signaling fairly dramatically. There are some who would argue, in fact, that they really only proceeded to enrich to 20% or 19.75% as a means of putting something out there that they could then bargain away that would be effectively low cost for them. The reactor has always been in existence. They're not talking about in any way pulling the reactor offline. They are talking about something that would curtail Iran's continuing enrichment at this higher level, which is of much greater concern with respect to its potential ability to create fissile material. But it may not be what comes out of Baghdad. It may be that we see something else that is effectively tangential to the core concern about the industrial scale enrichment that is going on, ostensibly for civilian power generation, but quite clearly with a different purpose in mind. The issue of the sanctions is a tremendous uncertainty. The Iranians have said very clearly that they expect some sort of sanctions relief in exchange for any concessions that they might put forward, the administration and to perhaps slightly less strenuously, the P5 plus one writ large have suggested that these sanctions are their trump card, and they are in no mood to suggest any sort of leniency, that the sanctions will go into effect on June 28th and July 3rd as anticipated, and there is no possibility. We'll wait and see. I think you're seeing a game of chicken on both sides, because in effect this is such a potentially valuable card. You know, if the Iranians are willing to put something quite substantial on the table, then perhaps that position might change on the part of the administration. We also have to factor in the situation in Europe, the concerns about the potential impact on fragile economies if and as we see Iran's imports fully pulled from the European market. So I think, you know, this is going to be an issue of tremendous significance, but I am quite skeptical, certainly in this environment, the political environment in Washington, that the U.S. measures will be in any way relaxed or rescinded, except in exchange for very dramatic gestures on the part of the Iranians.
Having served almost 4 years at NATO, I've had the misfortune of going to a lot of NATO summits and ministerials. The formal agendas are almost always arcane, esoteric, and incredibly boring. They spend a lot of time talking about transformation and things like this, which you almost need a linguist to help you understand what they're talking about. The good news is, though, that when the actual heads of state get together, they don't spend a lot of time worrying about the formal agenda, and they talk about the issues that are on their minds, and the Secretary General will encourage them to do that. So I would expect that there will be pretty broad-ranging conversations at these summits that cover probably all of these issues and maybe some that we haven't even touched on here. The practical outcome with regards to future pledges of financial support for the Afghan National Security Forces after 2014 can be dealt with relatively easily in Chicago. They can promise that they will do it. Since, like the United States, our fellow democracies cannot actually appropriate money years in advance, that requires their parliaments to support it. It's a good thing to do. It's a nice gesture. But you're not going to earn any interest on that check, since it's actually not going to be in the mail for at least 2 years.
We are at the 2:15 time cutoff, and before we go, I'd like to thank you all very much for coming out this afternoon and also thank the Managing Global Order Project for hosting us. But before everyone departs, also please join me in thanking both our speakers for excellent presentations.